of the Water Board. Our chair will be Chris Murray will be joining us momentarily. We are in person and via Zoom, and this meeting is being webcasted and recorded. For those who have completed a virtual speaking card for this Zoom meeting, you will be on mute and your camera will be turned off until it is your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your calendar if you have one. When you are done speaking, you will be placed on mute and your camera will be turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting or exit the meeting. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is also available. So, with that, I'd like to ask each of the board members to introduce themselves, beginning with Board Member Lopez.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Al Lopez. I'm the former mayor and councilman from City of Corona and also a past member of the Western Municipal Water District.
Board Member Alvarado.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. Gloria Alvarado, a resident of the City of Santa Ana. Proud to be here in this beautiful city. Thank you.
Okay, and is Board Member Rue available?
Yes, I am. I'm here. I'm joining you virtually today simply because my full-time work schedule is just really difficult right now. One of the few times I've not been able to join you in person. I am Bill Rue, councilmember for the City of Montclair, and proud to be a member of this board.
Okay. Thank you, Board Member Rue. And Board Member Letitia Clark is absent, and as I mentioned, Chair Murray will be joining us momentarily. So we have a quorum with a majority of the board here with us in person. So with that, I'd like to begin our public forum. Any person may address the Santa Ana Water Board on any matter within the board's jurisdiction, provided that the matter does not appear elsewhere on the agenda and has not been scheduled to appear on a future agenda and is not otherwise pending before the board. Do we have any public comments?
No, there are not.
Okay, thank you. All right. Our next item is going to be the State Water Resources Control Board's liaison report. We have with us today the Vice Chair of the State Water Resources Control Board, Doreen Diadamo, who will provide an update from the State Water Resources Control Board. And Dee Dee?
Good morning, Vice Chair and members of the board. I will not be turning my camera on today. I just had a minor surgical procedure, so, you know, I'm kind of feeling a bit not up to speed. So just going to give you a quick report, and we'll start off by just thanking those of you who were able to attend either remotely or in person at the annual Water Quality Coordinating Committee. This is something that we do once a year. Usually it's in the fall, and we weren't able to get it scheduled last October, so it was postponed until May. So we met on May 1st and 2nd and discussed a number of different important updated issues, heard from the governor's office, also heard from the Office of Chief Counsel. And I know Michael Laufer, our Chief Counsel, is working on updates to a document that was discussed at the meeting about just standard information, general guidelines for all board members, state and regional board members. So stay tuned for an update on that. And meeting recordings and materials are posted. I have a link that I'll be providing to Executive Officer Joy. Next item that I wanted to talk about is the Clean Water State Revolving Fund and Drinking Water State Revolving Fund. On May 6th, our board did adopt proposed amendments to the policy for implementing the Clean Water SRF and the policy for the Drinking Water SRF. And now we're going through the annual update of the intended use plan for both the Clean Water and the Drinking Water SRF.
And I believe we have, I have this information on a separate document, one second. I believe we have a workshop coming up on that. Sorry for bouncing around, 1 minute. Yes, we have a staff workshop on the Clean Water SRF on June 17th. And at that workshop, the Division of Financial Assistant will be providing information on the annual intended use plan to solicit input on the draft that was released on May 30th. I know there's a lot of interest in this for projects that are hoping to receive funding, and so that would be a good opportunity to receive more information about this coming year's intended use plan. Okay, also on June 17th, our staff will be providing us, along with other state entities, the California Air Resources Board, the Energy Commission, and the California Utilities Commission, on a information on the 2025 report of the Statewide Advisory Committee on Cooling Water Intake Structures. So they will, every year, they advise our board on implementation of the water quality control policy on use of coastal and estuarine waters for power plant cooling, also known as the once-through cooling policy. And this is important information for us to receive regarding grid reliability issues as we determine any adjustments to make for schedule for the once-through cooling policy. I apologize. I'm going back and forth between two different documents.
That's okay.
Okay, let's see. Usually better organized. Okay, so, and along those lines, we also heard at, so that's what's coming up at our next meeting, but at our meeting that we just had last week, we also were discussing once through cooling, specifically on mitigation funds. So for those facilities that continue in operation, we do have a requirement of fees for mitigation of coastal and marine impacts. And so on June 3rd, our staff and also representatives from the Ocean Protection Council and State Coastal Conservancy presented an information item for our board on once through cooling interim mitigation funds and on program expenditures. We did make, a few years ago, we made some adjustments to the fund so that the fees were increased. And we are closely following this to make sure that the program is being appropriately run. So we received feedback on the interim funds and also on revisions to an interagency memorandum of understanding on the acceptance and use of the mitigation funds for the program and milestones. We're accepting informal public feedback through June 21st, and more information is available on the Once Through Cooling program webpage. Okay, in May, we had our board meeting in the Coachella Valley to receive information and solicit public input regarding the status of the Salton Sea Management Program, specifically on Phase 1. I want to note that the program and restoration continues to be behind the original schedule. But this year was really, I think, enlightening for us because we're seeing that the program really is starting to pick up momentum and really excited to see some successful restoration efforts. You know, there a lot of these programs, restoration, restoring the lake bed playa in order to reduced the impacts of dust and other impacts. We're starting to see that those plantings are successful. And so that's been informative and hopefully The schedule of restoration projects will start to pick up speed. So I think next year will be really informative on that. On Delta conveyance, I know I've been reporting on this. Our administrative hearings office continues the hearings on the Delta conveyance project. And the hearing schedule, if you're interested in following, there's YouTube links in order to follow the hearings. And you can receive that information on the program webpage. At our meeting that we have next week, our board will be considering adoption of revisions to the draft cross-connection control policy handbook. And more information can be obtained on that on the program webpage for cross-connection control. And I'd like to highlight a project that we're involved in the San Joaquin Valley. It's involving wastewater, community wastewater services in East Orosi. So we received authority as a result of changes, statutory changes, to be able to designate a wastewater agency as designated for in need of administration and to provide for an administrator. So on April 17th, we conducted a public meeting to discuss the proposed identification of the East Orosi Community Services District as a designated sewer system. And at that meeting, we also identified that Tulare County, the resource management agency, as a proposed sewer system administrator for the community services district. Our executive officer, as part of our action, has been delegated the authority to adopt the resolution of findings and water quality order to designate them as a sewer system in need of an administrator and to appoint the sewer system administrator. And in August, our board will be certifying a funding agreement with Tulare County to execute funding for this project. So this is, an important first time that we're doing this. And so just really calling that out so that you're all aware of these new authorities that we have. And then the last item that I'll bring up is an update on sustainable groundwater management. I believe I've reported to you in the past that we have six basins, at this point seven, that have been referred to us for possible consideration. We did put two on probation, and there are two more that we are looking at, waiting to see revised updates of their plans. That's the Kauia Subbasin and the Kern Subbasin. But with this one that I'm reporting to you now on, the Chowchilla Subbasin, the Subbasin and the Groundwater Sustainability Agencies have made substantial changes to their groundwater sustainability plans, such that on June 3rd, our board officially returned the Subbasin to the Department of Water Resources. We think that this is an important milestone for the program, because it really does show that our interest is not in taking over basins to manage them, but actually to get the basins to a place where they develop plans that show information that connects the dots in the plans as to how the basins will be achieving sustainability over the 20-year period. And so Chowchilla was able to do that, and we're just really proud of them working closely with our board and our staff in order to allow us to be able to return the basin to the Department of Water Resources. Now they'll be going through an updated five-year plan, renewal, sort of a check. The next round really is focused on all these basins that are at the Department of Water Resources, not just on plans, but on implementation of the plans and achieving milestones. So that is all I have, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Good morning. Thank you, Dee Dee. We appreciate, as always, such a thorough report. I'd like to request if any of my colleagues, either here on the dais or participating remotely, have any questions.
Madam Chair, this is Bill Rue. I would like to ask Didi a question. In some of the work you're doing with these basins, and I know the San Joaquin Valley are having just driven through there for something to work, desperately needs...
Just a moment.
Rose, I'm on a Zoom, okay? Thanks, bye. I'm sorry about that. With the basins, and looking at how they're managed, is there any look at any... I'm trying to think of the right word to use right now. Is there any thought of consolidation of some of these basins?
Oh, okay, good question. So the basins have, they are, actually, there are two groundwater basins in the San Joaquin Valley, the Tulare Basin and the San Joaquin. And then what they've done is organize themselves according to sub-basins.
Right.
And within the sub-basins, there are multiple groundwater sustainability agencies. And the way the statute is drafted is it encourages local governance, local control. And so the only review that we have over how they've chosen to sort of manage and govern themselves is, first of all, on the basin boundaries, which the Department of Water Resources does have the authority over, sort of the lines that are drawn around basin boundaries, which is based on hydrology. And then on the groundwater sustainability agencies, that's up to the local communities to determine who should undertake that. You know, should it be the county? Should it be the local, say, irrigation district, or a new agency altogether, you know, that would get certified?
Okay.
And then the other important review is, are they organized in such a way that they have coordination amongst themselves? And that is a very important analysis.
And that is something that, you know, we look at as well. And it's been a concern, Kern County in particular, their basin, I think, started off with, you know, I think it was about 13 groundwater sustainability agencies. And then through time, it sort of grew. I don't know how many they have at this present time, but
okay,
it grew to as many as 18. And that did start to become a problem for analysis, because then you really have to make sure that the plans are coordinated in such a way that the basins are able to coordinate with each other. And so as far as consolidation, the only thing that would really push, you know, whether a basin has 1, 5, or 20 GSAs, is really related to the question of coordination. If they can show that they're appropriately coordinated, we want to defer to the local control. If it looks like they're not, then that could be actually a reason that they could be placed on probation.
Okay, that's essentially what I was asking. Sorry, I was a little flustered. I'm in my office and somebody called through. So, no, that answers my question. Thank you.
Yeah, it was a good question. Thank you for it.
Thank you, Board Member Vice Chair Scandura.
Sure. Well, thank you, Dee Dee, for the presentation. Along the similar lines as Board Member Rube, this is related to the item about struggling water districts and sewer service districts, and I'm aware that a number of them don't have boards, they don't have, or they may not have the staff or the funds to operate. And so this is a situation where Tulare County essentially took over. Do you know if there are any other situations where this is also occurring, especially are there any of these situations here in the Santa Ana region?
Yes, definitely. And so on that, I know there are many, but not anything specific comes to mind in Santa Ana, but we've had a very successful process for identification on the drinking water side, which, you know, we're a little bit further ahead on that piece because of the human right to water, safe drinking water. And the way we have sort of determined priorities is through a needs assessment. And that needs assessment is something on the drinking water side that's been already updated a couple of times. Wastewater is just now in that process. And so what I will do is
get information to your executive officer about anything coming up, because I know that there's an advisory committee
and they're analyzing these factors sort of as we speak, but I'm just not remembering where they are in the process. That'll be a very important document for your use and also for the public to kind of see who's out there, who's got challenges, and are there nearby systems where there's, you know, maybe opportunities for potential consolidation, or, you know, you could they could request the appointment of an administrator, or that's something that, we, you know, where we could come in and require it. So we have a lot of new tools that we didn't have in the past, and that's why I wanted to highlight Easterosi for you, because it'll be, I think, a good project for you to follow. But I'll follow up on the wastewater needs assessment information.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dee.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Any other questions or comments? Okay, great. Dee, thank you again for everything. We appreciate so much your leadership and your very thorough reports to our regional board meetings.
Thank you, Chair. Have a good, productive meeting.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye. So at this time, we will move on to item four, and that is our racial equity update on all our racial equity activities in our region, and I'd like to ask our executive officer, Jane Joy, to please provide that update.
I don't have a report for this time. We are continuing to work and look at our racial equity action plan, and we'll be giving an update in our July meeting.
Thank you so much. Moving on to item five, the Santa Ana Water Board will consider approval of minutes of the regional meeting of April 25th, 2025. I'd like to request at this time approval of the minutes.
Madam Chair, I make a motion for the item as presented. Bill Rue.
Thank you, Board Member Rue. Do I have a second?
I will second it.
Thank you, Board Member Alvarado. And Jessica, would you please call the vote?
Bartender Lopez?
Aye.
Bartender Alvarado?
Aye.
Bartender Rue?
Aye.
Vice Chair Scandora?
Aye.
And Chair Nuri?
Aye. And that item passes. We'll now move on to item six, which is consideration of the consent calendar, listed as items 7 through 11. At this time, I'd like to ask if there are any interested persons or board member requests to remove the consent item. And Jessica, if there are any speaker cards, please let us know.
No speaker cards were submitted.
Okay, great. Any board member comments? Seeing none, if there are no requests or comments, I'd like to request a motion for approval.
This is Bill Rue. I'll make a motion. Consent calendar as presented this morning.
Second.
Thank you.
Is there a
Board Member Lopez seconded.
I'll just add a comment. On item number 10, we did receive a very late letter. The comment letter itself relates to the CEQA for the document, which we are not the responsible party. So we feel legally acceptable to move forward with this item at this time.
Okay. Unless there are any questions, we have a motion and a second. Jessica, would you please call the vote?
Bartender Lopez?
Aye.
Bartender Alvarado?
Aye.
Bartender Rue?
Aye.
Vice Chair Scandora?
Aye.
And Chair Nuri?
Aye. And that item passes. We'll now move to item 12, which is an action item for the board to consider the waste discharge requirements for the in situ remediation of groundwater at the Century Lift facility in Huntington Beach. I'd like to invite Mona Baruz to present this item.
Thank you, Mona. Greetings, Chair Murray and dear board members. Would we have our slides on, please? I'm Mona Baruz, supervisor of the site cleanup program, along with my team member, Gabby Poches. It's our pleasure to provide you with the status of environmental investigation and remediation at a high-profile site in Huntington Beach. The subject site called Centralift Facility has been under our oversight of the site cleanup program for 3 decades now, and the project is ready to move from environmental investigation to remediation. And in today's presentation, we'll talk about the proposed waste discharge authorization and monitoring and reporting program for the subject site. Next, please. In today's presentation, we'll talk about the reasons that this case is a sensitive case, is a high-profile case, and also some of the challenges we face in environmental investigation and remediation, the nature of contaminant released, and also the proposed groundwater remediation. Next, please. So, illustrated in that square red square on the map is the location of the site is located in Huntington Beach. Why the case is sensitive? The case is located in less than 3 miles from the coast. And we have the Seal Beach National Wildlife Refuge in close proximity of that, a very important ecological resource to be protected. Next, please. Okay, so the map on the top shows the location of the site. In basically north to south direction, west of the site is Bolsa Chica Street, and we have the Naval Weapon Station of Seal Beach on the left of the facility. So at the bottom, you'll see blue shaded area, green shaded area, which are the land use around the site. So the historical release of hazardous chemical has happened at the subject facility, and the contamination has been transported off-site, primarily to the west and southwest. And you can see that the area is packed with industrial area. We have also the residential area. So the way that our environmental investigation and remediation works is that we start with the point of release, the source of release, and we step out to characterize and determine the extent of the plume. So for this subject facility, for some of the investigation locations, we find them, the appropriate location, within the public right-of-way. But in a lot of cases, we needed access to private properties, and those locations were appropriate location. In some instances, gaining access to those properties took us years. So that is one of the very challenging aspects of this project. In addition to that, west of the Bolsa Chica Street, we have the Seal Beach Naval Weapons Station. And as many of you may know, access to the Navy site is nearly impossible. Next, please. So this slide presents some of the technical challenges that we face for investigation and also remediation of the site. The map on the bottom of this page shows a geologic cross-section. So what does that mean is that you can think of it as taking a giant saw and cutting through the formation and creating a vertical slice of the formation. So different shades show different soil types and different lithology. This map is a very simplistic view, but still it shows the significance of variability in the formation. In addition to different soil types depicted by different shades, you also see that some of the lenses are thick, some are thin, some are continuous, some are discontinuous, and that just adds to the complexity of chemical transport in the subsurface. Depicted on the map, you see different nomenclatures. So on top, we have an unsaturated zone. Chemicals seep through the unsaturated zone, and they find their ways to the groundwater. So once the groundwater is encountered, we have lenses that are saturated with groundwater, and they are called water-bearing zones. So multiple water-bearing zones identified in the basically general area of the site have been impacted by historical releases at this subject site. Those are called upper fine grain unit, 45-foot sand zone, 75-foot sand zone, 110-foot sand zone, and then we get to the Alpha Aquifer. Why that is important? Because the contamination from the shallow aquifer can find its way to the deeper aquifers, and those deeper water-bearing zones are sources of drinking water for the city of Huntington Beach and must be protected. Next, please. So on the left, you see, again, a simplistic view of generation of what we call a groundwater plume. So when chemicals are released from the near the surface source area, they seep through the formation, they pass through the unsaturated zone, and they reach to the groundwater and create a volume of the groundwater that is no longer pristine. It's impacted by those chemicals. We call that volume of the water that is impacted by chemicals the groundwater plume. That groundwater plume moves with groundwater flow direction, in the groundwater flow direction. But it's not as simple as that. If you look at the map on the right, based on the interaction of different chemicals with different soil types, they can move in different directions. So the lithology controls how the plumes shape. So when they encounter the fine grain formation, the clay zone or sand zone, they may create different shapes of the plume. So in this specific site, two of the shallower water bearing zones that have been impacted are 45-foot sand zone and 75-foot sand zone, which are the topic of today's waste discharge authorization. With that, I'll pass it to Gabby.
Good morning, Chair Murray and distinguished board members. My name is Gabby Pocious, and I'm an engineering geologist with the site cleanup program at the Santa Ana Water Board and the current case manager for this site. And I'll go to the next slide. So as Mona mentioned, the site today is the Centralift facility, and this is located in Huntington Beach. In the image, you'll see that the site is outlined in red, and the site consists of a large commercial building along with some storage areas and parking for the workers there. The Centralift facility operated, was an industrial site that rebuilt and serviced pumps that were used in the water resource and petroleum industry. And those operations began in 1976 and continue to this day. The part of the operations here also included cleaning and degreasing of the pumps. And in order to do that, there were solvents that were used. And those solvents were mainly volatile organic compounds and primarily PCE, TCE, and 1,4-dioxane. And I'll go to the next slide. These contaminants that we've identified at the site, we have three former source areas where those concentrations are the highest, and those three are listed here, the former North clarifier, the former three-stage clarifier, and the concrete-lined trench, along with their uses in parentheses on that image. And these are located in that northwest portion of the site, northwest of the building, so in kind of you could see the building outline there. Next slide. So as Mona touched on, we have very complex geology at the site, and she's already listed the nomenclature for these water-bearing zones, so I won't go into much detail. But I, again, would like to highlight that there are impacts in the deeper aquifers, the Alpha Aquifer, and even deeper is a Beta Aquifer that has yet to be investigated, but there are plans to in the future. And again, that these are regional aquifers used for drinking water purposes, and these are impacts up down to 200 feet below ground surface. However, the topic of today that I'll go into more detail are the ones highlighted in red, the 45-foot sand zone and the 75-foot sand zone. Next slide. So before we get into some impacts that we see today, I wanted to touch on some historical remediations that happened. There were two rounds of excavations that were conducted. Those locations are shown in red, and in blue, in green, we have the building there. And so, like I said, two excavations in 2010 and 2012. These excavations were conducted using large diameter augers. And those circles, those images on the right with the circles are indicating the different size augers that were used for this excavation. And they did excavate down to approximately 37 feet below ground surface. And however, the extensive impacts are beyond the excavation zone. And mass does remain in place even after this and continues to impact the site. Next slide. So to get into what we see today at the site, I have some plume maps of both zones of our topic of discussion. And first one we have is a 45-foot sand zone. And this is the groundwater plume that we see for total volatile organic compounds. Up in the right-hand corner, you'll see the green box, which is the site building. And if you where those cluster of blue dots are in the northwest portion is where those former source areas are. And that is where the plume has begun in the 45-foot sand zone. You'll see it kind of trail towards the southwest-west direction, and that is the flow of groundwater in this zone. And the lighter shade of red, almost pink color that you see, are concentrations that exceed 100 micrograms per liter. And the darker shade are concentrations greater than 1,000 micrograms per liter. And we have, as you see, the blues are a series of monitoring wells that go across the site. And all the way to the left, we have Bolsa Chica Street. And if you recall, past this is that naval operations site that we don't have access to. I would also like to note that these concentrations are exceeding the California maximum contaminant level to how we delineate the plume. However, we don't see that line here due to those high impacts at the site. And next slide. So next we have the plume maps for the 75-foot sand zone. Due to the thickness of this zone, the consultant has separated it into an upper portion and a lower portion. And that distinguishing is about 90 feet below ground surface is the middle of those zones. So 75 to 90 for upper and 90 to 105 for lower. And again, everything I mentioned about the legend, it does apply to these maps, with the green being the site building. However, the blue arrows that you see is the groundwater flow direction, which you'll notice is in a different direction from the 45-foot sand zone. So this groundwater flows more towards the north-northwest. You'll notice on the upper zone, we have added a red dashed line for concentrations greater than 100 micrograms per liter. This is our depiction of the plume, and it's a way to just be most conservative because we do not have data points between where you see those circles, those isolated plumes. And so we have that 100 to kind of be more conservative. And the lower zone, you'll see those impacts again at the site and flowing with the groundwater flow direction. Next slide. So now that we know what impacts look like at the site today, and over several years of investigation, the site is ready to move forward with some remediation and testing the effectiveness of different remediations at two different zones. So at the site, they have proposed to do some source area in situ chemical oxidation at those former source areas. And then along Bolsa Chica Street, we have a Bolsa Chica reactive zone. And this one is to prevent further migration of contaminants within that 45-foot sand zone and just kind of stop the plume, stop any further migration of the plume there. And I'll go into more details on exactly what each area will consist of. So next slide. Here we have the Bolsa Chica reactive zone in a larger figure. This reactive zone will consist of 105 direct push locations and will cover about 840 feet along Bolsa Chica Street. And again, Naval Operations Base to the west, where we do not have access. However, we do have a series of monitoring wells up gradient within the reactive zone and down gradient to monitor what the plume looks like as it flows through this reactive zone. And this will be how we test to monitor to see the effectiveness here. And the reason for this item being an individual WDR is because we do not have any monitoring wells further down gradient that show non-detect for the contaminants of concern. And next slide, I wanted to kind of give a brief overview of what direct push injections consist of. On the left, we have an image of a direct push rig, which essentially takes a metal rod and by using pressure just pushes it straight into the ground. On the right, we have a schematic of how a reactive zone may work or should work. In this schematic, it's showing three direct push in locations. However, remember, the one for this site will consist of over 100 points, much larger scale. And so in this schematic, we have the three direct push locations driven down to the target depth. And as amendments get injected into the ground, it creates this reactive zone, which is shown in purple. We then have the red portion of the groundwater plume where we see those contaminants, and the groundwater will flow through this reactive zone, and those contaminants will then react with the amendments, and then we will have the treated groundwater continue to flow down gradient, and we will monitor those changes with those down gradient wells that I had mentioned. Next slide. So next, moving to the source area in situ chemical oxidation. This one, again, is happening at the site in those former source areas. And you'll notice those hash marks are where the previous soil excavations were conducted to kind of help align you all with the site. And these injections will be conducted using injection wells within the 45-foot sand zone and the 75-foot sand zone, using those amendments listed there. And to kind of talk through how this will work, I have another slide. The source area injections are going to be conducted in two stages. We have stage one that will include injection of those amendments into those injection wells and allow the groundwater to naturally disperse the amendments and react with the contaminants in the groundwater. Once certain criteria is met and we receive written approval from our executive officer, they will move forward with stage two injections, which will again consist of another round of injection of amendment and then paired with temporary groundwater extraction to help disperse or to help enhance the dispersion of the amendments within each of these zones. It might be hard to tell on these figures, but the injection wells begin on the upgradient side of the plumes within each zone, and then we have those extraction wells further down gradient of the injection wells to help that recirculation. And we have a series of monitoring wells within the treatment area, again, to monitor those effectiveness and see when when certain criteria is met. Next slide. So in summary, based on the items we discussed with you, Mona and I discussed with you, we have this is a very high profile case that is under our oversight. And after decades of investigation and the known contaminants, the site's ready to move forward with testing the effectiveness and moving towards remediation to clean up how they have contaminated the groundwater here. So we recommend that the board adopts the proposed waste discharge authorization and its attached monitoring and reporting program. Next slide. So we'd like to thank you for your time and attention today, and we'd like to acknowledge the previous stakeholders and current stakeholders that have gotten the case to where it is today, and we'll take any questions.
Thank you both so much for the presentation, the overview for our benefit and the public's. At this time, I'd like to see if we have any speaker cards. Jessica, is there anyone who would like to speak on this item?
No, there's no speaker cards.
Okay, thank you. Then I'd like to turn it over to the board online or in person. I know Vice Chair Scandura has just, so I'll turn it over to him. But Bill, definitely let us know if you have any questions on your end as well.
Okay. Well, thank you for the excellent presentations. It's rather ironic because to get to this meeting this morning, I drove from my house to, where else but Bolsa Chica Street, and then straight up Bolsa Chica Street to the 22 freeway. So it's and it's an area I'm very familiar with. Now, what's interesting is along Bolsa Chica Street, where are they going to actually be doing the if they can't get onto the Naval Weapons Station, then where would they be doing the direct push injection? Will it be in the street or in that real narrow area between the channel and the street?
Yes, thank you for your question. The direct push locations are going to be occurring at the east side of Bolsa Chica along that sidewalk. We then have
sidewalk.
Yes, and then the down gradient injection, down gradient monitoring wells are going to be located in the middle section of Bolsa Chica. So, like you mentioned, it is a small area. We're working with a small area to get this installed. However, we will be those in all the monitoring wells for that area have already been installed. So that was a good step forward, and now they're just waiting to move forward with those direct push locations.
Okay, and then the direct push is actually going to be in the sidewalk on the eastern side, which I'm familiar with, and I imagine you're all coordinating with the city of Huntington Beach, the Public Works Department, and all those people.
Correct.
Yeah.
It took years for planning this, basically the location of the injection locations and also the monitoring location to get permit for installation of those wells with the limitations that we had. So these are the best locations we could find.
Okay. And then there was another question I was going to ask, but I forgot it. So I'll let the other board members.
Board Member Lopez or Alvarado? I couldn't see who's.
My question was on slide number six. Where's slide number six? The lead plume. Could you describe a little bit about that? The lead plume.
The leading edge of the plume?
Yes.
So when the chemicals are seeped through the formation, as explained, they pass through the unsaturated zone. We also call it vadose zone. Then they will find their way to impact different lenses of groundwater, those water bearing zones, and they impact a volume of the groundwater depending on the magnitude of the chemical release.
Mm-hmm.
So that plume of chemical will move in the direction of the groundwater. Can we have slide number six, please? So that plume has a leading edge that basically travels with the groundwater. So the front, basically, edge of the groundwater plume, we call it leading edge of the plume. So for this specific site, the leading edge of the plume has reached the Bolsa Chica Street, and it's critical to stop that and prevent further degradation of the groundwater in coastal areas, and also it will communicate with seawater in, the map on the left. So that leading edge of the plume is the front edge of the plume that moves with the groundwater flow.
And what's the projected movement of it? How fast is it moving?
It moves with the groundwater. In average, the velocity of the groundwater is about 100 feet per year, but it can be impacted by other effects like significant recharge, human activities, significant pumping. So all would impact the average groundwater velocity.
Thank you.
Thank you, Board Member Lopez. Any other questions?
Oh, I finally remembered.
There you go. I hear you.
Okay.
For sure.
So on your plume map, where you showed the high concentrations, I mean, some of them, I mean, up to about 5,000-6,000 parts per million off-site, were those all in the 45-foot zone?
Yes. The 45-foot sand zone is one of the shallower water-bearing zones
right.
that do have the higher impacts. And the one that is kind of the long, skinny plume image is, I think, what you may be referring
right.
to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there are future plans to to target the middle area of the plume. However, these are the first steps to see how this remediation technology will work, and then we'll move forward with addressing the other different areas.
Right. Do they have data for the 75-foot zone? I mean, what kind of concentrations are we seeing there?
Yes. If we want to, actually, I think I could go to the next slide with this. Go back.
That's the 75.
Yeah, so the 75, and it does flow in a different direction. So where you see those high impacts of the 45-foot sand zone, mm-hmm. We don't have 75-foot sand zone wells there because of the different flow direction. So these are the concentrations we see within those zones.
And that's definitely very high.
Yes.
At least one thing is we do have the Bolsa Chica channel, so it's hoped that that channel will act as a hydraulic barrier to keep the contaminants from going onto the Naval Weapons Station. And then the last question I just wanted to verify is that, so for the Bolsa Chica reactive zone, that's seen as more or less a final remedy, whereas for the work on site, that's still pilot scale, so that's still evaluating whether that's going to be an effective remedy. And then if it does work, then they're going to have to come back for future WDRs from us.
Right. I wouldn't necessarily say that the Bolsa Chica is the final remedy. It is definitely a large scale because we want to prevent that migration, and we're hoping that this first round will work. However, if we do continue to see impacts, there may be additional WDRs be issued to replenish the reactive zone, maybe do additional rounds, maybe try different techniques. And then, yes, with the pilot scale at the source area, it is a much smaller area.
Yeah.
And so we will see how that works. And again, same thing, see if there's different technologies, different areas to target.
Okay. Well, I look forward to the project. I don't look forward to the road closure on Bolsa Chica Street, though.
Absolutely. So to just add to what Gabby mentioned, a project in this scale with this significant impact that it has created both laterally and also vertically, so that alpha aquifer that you noted and is impacted from the historical releases at the site is approximately to the depth of 180 feet below ground surface. So this kind of plume requires several phases of remediation. So as you noted, excavation was conducted to just remove the hot source in soil, primarily in soil. And then we have this reactive zone installed for just stopping the plume in 45-foot sand. We are just doing a pilot test in 45 and 75-foot sand. However, depending on the success of that remedy, it should be scaled up. There are a lot of concentrations between the site and Bolsa Chica that need to be addressed. Several transects are in planning, basically transects of reactive zone that will be installed. In addition, the lower water bearing zones need remediation. So hopefully in near future, we'll update the board about the progress on this project.
We definitely want to keep updated on this because I do recognize a very complex site, regardless of where it's located. So,
absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you. If there are no other requests or comments, I'd like to request a motion and a second to approve staff's recommendation.
Madam Chair, this is Bill Rue. I will make a motion for staff's recommendation as presented this morning.
Thank you, Board Member Rue. Do we have a second?
I will second.
All right. Seconded by Board Member Alvarado. Jessica, would you please call the vote?
Board Member Lopez?
Aye.
Board Member Alvarado?
Aye.
Board Member Rue?
Aye.
Vice Chair Scandora?
Aye.
And Chair Nuri?
Aye. And the item passes. Thank you both.
Thank you.
We'll move on to item 13, enforcement policy update. And the Santa Ana board staff has invited the State Water Resources Control Board's Office of Enforcement to present an overview of the enforcement policy. At this time, I'd like to invite Eric Lindberg to introduce the State Water Board's 2024 enforcement policy update.
Thank you, Chair Murray. I've asked Assistant Chief Counsel David Boyers and Attorney for Catherine Haw to be here today. They're some of my favorite people. I've really enjoyed working with them at the Office of Enforcement, and they're going to do a great job filling you in on the new 2024 enforcement policy, which was adopted all the way back in December 2023 and recently cleared the Office of Administrative Law after some delay. The policy aims to protect and enhance the quality of California's waters by defining enforcement processes and addresses water quality problems in a fair, efficient, and consistent manner. The key principles at the risk of stealing David's thunder are fair, firm, consistent, and transparent enforcement, which I think the board members will appreciate that our staff take to heart. There are three special considerations I'd like to point out. The policy emphasizes the fair treatment of all people and prioritizes enforcement in communities disproportionately affected by pollution. The policy encourages meaningful consultation and collaboration with California Native American tribes when enforcement actions impact tribal lands and interests. And lastly, the policy recognizes the unique compliance challenges faced by small and disadvantaged communities and prioritizes informal enforcement and compliance assistance in those communities. Again, your staff take these considerations to heart, and I hope that you find this information item useful. So I'll hand that over.
Good morning. Can folks hear me okay? Okay. If I stray too far from the mic, please just flag me and I'll move it closer. Thank you so much, Eric, for the introduction. It's nice to hear that I'm one of your favorite people. Always good to hear. And thank you, Madam Chair and honorable board members. Yes, I am David Boyers. I'm an assistant chief counsel in the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement. With me today is one of my colleagues, an attorney for in the Office of Enforcement, Catherine Haw. And today we will be presenting an overview for you of the State Water Board's water quality enforcement policy. And within that context, we will be highlighting some of the recent changes that the board adopted to the policy, which Eric referenced. Those changes took effect and were approved by the Office of Administrative Law in November of 2024. So we've had it for a short period of time. Catherine and I, be doing somewhat of a deeper dive in the process for how we reach settlement agreements, and we'll be talking to you about that. And then finally, we'll talk to you about the projects that are available to you in settlement, things like SEPs and ECAs. Where do I point this? There we go. Oh, okay. It's on a delay. Let's see if we could do that. There we go. All right. So with generally everything that you do and the other eight regional water boards, the overarching goal is the protection of water quality. And enforcement is no different. The State Board's primary goal in creating the enforcement policy is protecting water quality, and this is a quote directly from the policy, by defining an enforcement process that addresses water quality problems in the most efficient, effective, and consistent manner. And this is what Eric referred to earlier. The policy provides guidance on the various elements of the enforcement process, which I have condensed for you on this slide into three main components. The first is to identify and prioritize those cases that merit enforcement. And the policy provides guidance on what types of violations should receive discretionary enforcement, giving consideration to three things. Number one, the severity of impacts to beneficial uses, the level of disregard to the requirements, whether that be an order requirement or a statutory requirement, and then the deviation from the applicable standard. So, for example, a sanitary sewer overflow that impacts public health would be considered a high priority violation that we would certainly want to bring some enforcement against. The second portion of the policy, and this we'll spend a lot of time on this, and this is a significant portion of the policy, is determining how much of a penalty is appropriate. And the policy sets forth a detailed 10-step methodology used to calculate that liability, considering certain factors that are provided to you in the statute. So imposing an appropriate liability does three things. It levels the playing field so that those who violate do not achieve an economic benefit. It creates a deterrent for both the persons who violate it and for the regulated community. And then finally, imposing an appropriate liability assures the public that we're willing to back up our regulatory requirements with action. And the final component of this policy is to provide a process and timelines for bringing enforcement, including the establishing alternatives to paid liability and allowing projects through settlement, things like enhanced compliance actions, SEPs, and compliance projects. So in the policy, the State Board has said that we should revise the policy every 5 years. This ensures that we're making those necessary adjustments to keep the policy as streamlined and efficient as possible. And I think we've done a pretty good job. There have been 4 amendments. We originally adopted the policy in 2002, and it has been amended 3 times since then. The most significant revisions to the policy were actually in the 2010 version, and that is where we first added our 10-step penalty methodology. In 2017, we amended it again to kind of fine-tune that methodology and add further clarification to the enforcement process. And now these last revisions are fairly minor and what I would call surgical. So if you're not familiar with the policy, the things that I'm going to talk about today may be a little bit in the weeds, but we're going to provide some background to hopefully give you some context for those revisions. Okay, so specifically the revisions that Catherine and I will be discussing today fall generally within the 4 categories on the screen, which coincide with those major components of the policy that I talked about earlier. And I've categorized these changes made to the prioritization and communication provisions, the penalty methodology, issues related to settlement, and finally, process and procedures. So as I said, we'll give a brief overview of each of these sections before we discuss the specific updates. Catherine's going to take over and cover number 1 and 4, and I will do 2 and 3. And with that, I'll turn it over to Catherine.
Good morning, Board Chair, members of the board. It's a pleasure to be in front of you this morning. I'm going to talk now. Okay, yeah. If I'm quiet, please let me know because it is the microphone's a little far away. But so I'm going to talk now a little bit about prioritization and communication. The policy provides guidance on how to prioritize and communicate with the public regarding enforcement. The primary directive within the policy is to meet quarterly, and the regional board's enforcement coordinator meets in coordination with Office of Enforcement Attorneys assigned to your region, which I have been serving in that role for most of my career. So I can confirm that your staff have, in fact, been meeting this obligation to meet quarterly and to discuss and prioritize cases as part of that enforcement prioritization process. As part of this process, attorneys and staff discuss particular cases and alleged violations to determine whether or not they fall within the policy's category of either Class A or Class B violations. And this depends on the severity of impact to beneficial uses, the level of the regulated entity's disregard for the applicable requirement. And certain kinds of violations are always considered Class A. And those include unauthorized discharges with impacts to municipal drinking water, discharges that result in fish kills, and discharges of fill to wetlands. So those requirements I just discussed have existed in the policy for a long time. In terms of some of the surgical updates that David mentioned, we included in the 2024 version of the policy. I'm going to highlight some of those as they relate to prioritization and communication now. First, we added a consideration of whether an violation impacts or threatens to impact an environmental justice or disadvantaged community. Most of the regional boards that we work with are already considering impacts to DAC or EJ communities as part of their prioritization. So while this is largely a clarification, it's an important one nonetheless as we strive to do more to protect our underserved communities. As part of the update, we also incorporated the Water Board's existing racial equity resolution, which directs us to prioritize enforcement where there is an undue impact on Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And the policy also specifies that staff can utilize Cal Enviro Screen to determine whether or not a community satisfies some of these definitions. And I'm going to have a more specific discussion on Cal Enviro Screen in a later slide. And then, as Eric mentioned, we've also added an entirely new section recognizing the importance of engaging with California Native American tribes on a government-to-government basis, consistent with our Water Board's tribal consultation policy. As just described, any community which is characterized as a disadvantaged community in Cal Enviro Screen will be considered as such for the purposes of our enforcement. So the new language in the enforcement policy identifies specific definitions from various statutory provisions, which can also be considered when determining whether or not a community is disadvantaged or an environmental justice community. Overall, the inclusion of the reference to both Cal Enviro Screen and these statutory provisions, which are up on the screen, is intended to be inclusive and to give regional board staff broad discretion to determine whether or not a community satisfies one of these categories in order to support a finding that it is a DAC or EJ community for the purposes of our enforcement actions. Okay, and then lastly, with regards to prioritization and communication, these are, again, very minor changes to the policy, but worth highlighting here, which is that there have been some modifications to the kinds of violations which are characterized as Class A violations. For example, discharges of sewage solely to land that are promptly cleaned up will no longer be characterized as Class A violations. There also has been an amendment to reflect that statewide enforcement priorities need only be updated when necessary. Previously, they were required to be updated every 2 years, but we didn't find that it was helpful or necessary to have to update them so frequently.
And I should have mentioned when I started that we have 45 slides. We cover a lot of material. If you have a question during this, please feel free to interrupt me. Or if you just want to ask a general question about enforcement, something's on your mind, feel free. Don't necessarily have to sit through 45 slides and just listen. So, okay, so I'm going to talk about how we calculate penalties. Sorry. Using the penalty methodology, and then highlight some of the revisions to the policy that we made related to the calculation of liability. So here on the screen are some of the water code authorities. You'll notice that there may be authorities that you've seen before. We use these regularly, our enforcement actions. And you'll see they provide fairly significant potential liabilities for violations. 13385 is your general NPDES enforcement statute. It's $10,000 a day and $10 a gallon for each discharge. 13350, you'll see when we bring violations for cease and desist orders or cleanup and abatement orders, it's generally the same, $5,000 a day or $10 per gallon. And then some others, 13268 and 13261 provide $1,000 a day. When determining the liability amount for a violation, the Water Code requires that the Water Boards consider a number of factors, including the nature, circumstance, extent, and gravity of the violation. And if the violation involves a discharge, the Water Code says to consider the degree of toxicity of the material discharged, whether it was susceptible to cleanup or abatement. The Water Code also requires that you look at the conduct of the discharger and take into consideration their degree of culpability, whether they did any voluntary cleanup in response to the violation, and whether they have a history of violations. And finally, the Code says we must consider the economic benefit obtained from the violation, the discharger's ability to pay, and anything else that justice may require. And at a minimum, the penalty must be assessed at a level that recovers the economic benefit plus 10%. And as I said, the enforcement policy sets forth a detailed methodology that provides a stepwise approach for the Water Boards to consider each of these statutory factors to calculate the proposed liability. And the goal of this methodology is actually, as Eric mentioned earlier, is to create a fair, transparent, and consistent statewide approach to assessing liability. Please don't attempt to read what's on this slide. I'm going to cover this in the next several slides. This is just a very broad overview of the 10-step methodology, and we're going to go over each of these three parts now. So the first part looks at the violation itself and sets an initial liability based on the overall gravity of the violation. If we have a discharge violation, we start with step one and calculate what we call the total or potential harm score. And that score is made up of three things: the toxicity of the material discharged on a scale from 0 to 4, with 4 being the most toxic; the harm or potential harm to beneficial uses on a scale of 0 to 5, with 5 being the most harmful; and the susceptibility to cleanup, with 1 meaning no cleanup was possible and 0 meaning the material could be cleaned up. And we add those numbers together, which gives us our final harm score. Step 2 considers how far the violation deviated from the underlying requirement, either a minor, moderate, or major deviation, and assigns a percentage multiplier for the maximum liability in the statute. This table in the enforcement policy establishes the multiplier based on the potential for harm score and the deviation. So, for example, a violation that receives a harm score of 9 and a moderate deviation from requirement would get a multiplier of 0.5, meaning the initial liability would be 50% of the statutory maximum for the days of violation and the gallons discharged. Step 3 is essentially that same process, but for non-discharge violations. The second major part of the methodology considers the conduct of the violator and either increases or decreases the initial liability based on that conduct. And here we look at three variables: the discharger's culpability, which is the act that gave rise to the violation; their cleanup and cooperation, this is how they responded to the violation; and their history of violations. For culpability and cleanup, a neutral score of 1 represents that they met the expected standard of care, while a score above 1 means the discharger failed to meet the standard of care, which results in an increase in liability. So if we multiply it by 1.2, that is essentially a 20% increase in the liability that we decided was appropriate in that first part. And if we have a score below 1, that means they exceeded the standard of care and a penalty would be reduced accordingly. For history of violations, if there is a history, then we ought to assign at least a 1.1. If there's no history, well, then they did what they should have done and they get a score of 1, no change in the penalty. Step 5 is doing the math. The last part of the methodology is really just a final check on the total base liability amount to ensure that nothing else warrants an adjustment. And we look at a number of things here, including the discharger's ability to pay, the economic benefit derived from the violation, and any other factors as justice may require. And last, we have to make sure that the final liability amount is within the statutory maximum and the minimum. And I'll note, if we seek to increase the liability to recover staff costs, we do that under Step 8, Other Factors. Take a quick sidebar and talk about collapsing days. Often, unfortunately, we see violations that last a long period of time, especially reporting violations. Sometimes it can be months. Sometimes we see violations that last years. And as you remember, we have very powerful authority. So if you're looking at a penalty of $1,000 a day for a lengthy violation, that can get very big very fast. And so the policy allows that these days be reduced using a formula that's shown on the screen in order to arrive at a more reasonable penalty amount. In order to collapse days, one of three findings must be made. There are no daily detrimental impacts to the environment occurring. There is no daily economic benefit to be gained, or the violation occurred without the discharger's knowledge or control. And I'll note that reducing the days of violation is discretionary. You are not required to do this, and there are cases where we decline to do this. One final sidebar on high volume discharges. We often see when it rains a lot, there are violations, either in the form of stormwater runoff at, say, a construction site or an industrial site, or sometimes we see sanitary sewer overflows that are caused by inflow and infiltration. So the enforcement policy provides that for high volume discharges of sewage and stormwater, a reduction in the $10 per gallon maximum may be used when determining the initial liability amount. For discharges between 100,000 gallons and 2 million gallons, you may elect to reduce the per gallon amount down to $2, anywhere between 2 and 10. And for super high volume discharges over 2 million gallons, the policy allows you to use $1 as the maximum. Again, this reduction is discretionary. It is not mandatory. All right, so that's the background. We'll talk a little bit about the changes that we made to the methodology. My apologies if these are somewhat in the weeds. This first slide really shows changes to reflect our current practice. We moved the section on collapsing days for non-discharge violations to step three. Previously, it was after step three, and that didn't make any sense. We clarified it's never appropriate to collapse days for discharge violations. We have also switched steps six and eight so that we consider a discharger's ability to pay after everything else. And again, this just reflects our current practice. So these are fairly minor revisions. In addition, in step four of the methodology, this is where we consider the discharger's conduct. We clarified that not taking action to correct a violation that has been brought to the discharger's attention may be relevant to both culpability and cleanup and cooperation. And the way we see this in the real world is you'll have an inspector go out to a site and they'll note certain violations for the discharger. Those initial violations, they're culpable for those because they ought to know what's in their permit. But when we come back a second and third time and we see the same violations, well, then that also goes to their reaction to the violation. So their cleanup and cooperation factor also goes up. So it's really important for the regulated community not only to follow what's in their permit, but then to make corrections when our inspectors go out and note violations. And if they don't, it's going to raise the penalty for that violation. Also in step four, we clarified that only stipulated and adjudicated violations should be considered when we're factoring a history, making it clear that alleged violations should not be considered. And this is really just a matter of due process, right? We can allege lots of violations. We generally think our allegations are true and correct, but until the discharger has an opportunity to come before you and argue that, we don't typically use that as a history. Okay. Finally, as I said before, the enforcement policy allows us to adjust the liability in consideration of our staff costs. Here in the new policy, we added language to strongly encourage that staff costs be recovered when imposing a liability. Oftentimes, these enforcement actions take a ton of staff time, and we invest a lot of resources into these violations and presenting them to you. We think it's appropriate that those costs of investigation and enforcement be borne by the discharger and not the taxpayer. Okay. Most of our cases, thankfully, are cases that we settle. My estimate is that about 90% of our cases settle, and there's lots of benefits to settlement. Certainty in the outcome, fewer staff resources, and perhaps most importantly, the ability to include terms that are not available if liability is imposed by you after a contested hearing. We'll talk about this in more detail later. For ACLs that do settle and that do not settle and proceed to a contested hearing, the statute directs that the penalty money be paid either to the cleanup and abatement account or the waste discharge permit fund. In settlement, however, we do have more flexibility, and we can offset some of that money to allow for certain environmentally beneficial projects, supplemental environmental projects, enhanced compliance actions, and compliance projects. And just really briefly, SEPs are projects that are generally enhance water quality and provide a benefit to the public at large. These are things like habitat restoration projects. Enhanced compliance projects are generally capital or operational improvement projects that go beyond what the permit requires. These are things like, you know, state-of-the-art equipment or smart manhole covers. And then compliance projects are projects that just bring the discharger back into compliance. These are things that the discharger is already obligated to do. And the statute limits these to those cases that involve mandatory minimum penalties against small communities with a financial hardship. Okay, so here's what we did in the last iteration of the updates. We clarified that compliance projects are only allowed where authorized by statute. And that is, again, MMPs for small communities with a financial hardship. If you're inclined to compel somebody to come back into compliance, the correct tool is a cleanup and abatement order or a cease and desist order. What you can't do is impose a liability and then suspend it all and say, we'll hold it in abeyance if you come back into compliance. You can only do that in a very limited set of circumstances. We've also clarified that enhanced compliance actions are only allowed to offset discretionary penalties. And we have added new language to encourage outreach when we settle a case for those cases where we have ECAs or SEPs that impact or are located in an EJ community or a DAC community or a tribal area. It encourages us to do some consultation and outreach with those groups. Back to Catherine.
The last set of revisions that we're going to cover today are related to process and procedures. The first change shown here relates to the timing of imposition of mandatory minimum penalties, or MMPs. The revised policy clarifies that violations which give rise to MMPs should be addressed within 18 months, but recognizes that this is a difficult deadline to meet for the stormwater programs. And your region in particular does have TMDL-related requirements in its stormwater programs that need to be enforced. So your staff have been working very diligently to manually review all of the data necessary to impose those MMPs. But unlike the wastewater programs, which have had the MMPs in place for quite a long time and have a lot of technical support on the back end, this requires a lot of manual review in the stormwater program. So this amendment was added in order to allow for additional time where there are fewer technical resources to support in imposing those MMPs. A footnote related to latches has been removed. That footnote became irrelevant between the 2017 and 2024 policy due to some more recent case law. This revision also incorporates guidance, which your staff have been receiving from the attorneys at the State Water Board related to when orders can be combined with other documents. So we do not advise the issuance of notices of violations with any sort of order which could be subject to petition. So now we issue those as separate documents in order to be clear to the regulated community what exactly they may petition and what is a non-petitionable action. And then I'll talk a little bit more about appendixes D and E specifically, but those are also new additions to provide direction on which policy applies to what sorts of violations and on template hearing procedures for administrative civil liability hearings that do make their way to be heard in front of the board. We've talked a lot about impacted communities and DAC and EJ communities, but some of the additional language which is added here provides direction to staff on engaging with DAC or EJ communities as part of their enforcement action and working to identify where our enforcement actions can benefit from the community's input, especially when those communities are DAC or EJ communities or California Native American tribes. There are some resources, both within the regional board and at the state board, for doing and engaging in this work. Every regional board has an environmental justice liaison, and then the Office of Public Participation at the State Water Board also provides some services in the form of translation and with doing outreach and identifying groups that are, you know, in your community in order to do that outreach. Those resources are available, and staff can avail themselves of them. Oh, I wasn't patient. Okay, so let's talk about Appendix D now. So Appendix D relates to which policy applies to what sorts of violation. So as David had up on the screen earlier, this is not the only iteration of the enforcement policy. And so there are three kinds of changes or new language to the enforcement policy. They're characterized as either clarifications, procedural changes, or substantive changes. The effective date for this policy is November 7th, 2024. So clarifications and procedural changes are being implemented now. Substantive changes require the most diligent analyses because substantive changes only apply to violations which occur after the effective date of the new policy. However, there are only two changes to the enforcement policy, which is which we are characterizing as substantive changes, and those are the prohibition on collapsing days of violation for discharge violations and the revised definition of violations in the context of history of violations, which David talked about earlier. So if your staff have any questions, they know how to reach out to us, and we are working on a case-by-case basis to ensure that this guidance is implemented. But the inclusion of Appendix D is intended to provide transparency and information to the regulated community about how we're approaching the application of the various policies. This is repetitive of what I just said, but again, there's only two changes which are considered as substantive, and they're fairly minor in nature. All right, Appendix E is the second appendix which has been added to the enforcement policy. Appendix E relates to the addition of template hearing procedures. These templates are intended to provide consistent hearing for actions which are heard in front of the regional boards. They apply to any evidentiary hearing which is issued, or excuse me, any evidentiary hearing on an administrative civil liability issued pursuant to Water Code Section 13.323. So all of the statutory provisions which David mentioned earlier, Water Code Section 13.385, 13.350, et cetera, those all come in front of you under this provision, and will have similar hearing procedures based on this template. The template is designed to be adopted in a case-specific format, so it can always be modified as appropriate, depending on the jurisdiction or the body which we're going to bring the enforcement action and the particular facts of that case and nuances that may be appropriate to incorporate for a particular matter. The process by which the hearing procedure will be drafted and issued is such that the prosecution team will reach out to the advisory team, which generally consists of your EO and OCC attorney, to coordinate and get guidance on filling out the template prior to issuance. This doesn't include the discharger, though generally we're subject to a prohibition on ex parte communications related to enforcement. This falls outside of that realm and is just a procedural communication to make sure the board is available for a particular date and that, you know, names and contact information is correct. And then once the prosecution team issues the complaint, they will concurrently include the hearing procedures with the complaint.
Okay. We're getting there. We're going to shift gears a little bit, and I'm going to talk to you about settlements. And what I'm talking about here are those administrative settlements that come before you as decision makers. You may also be involved in cases that you have referred to the Attorney General's office, and in those cases you serve as the client and make decisions as the client. But here you're serving as the judge. And so this graphic in the Wizard of Oz, Toto's Toto, Dorothy's dog, famously pulls back the curtain, revealing the great and powerful Oz is actually just a man operating machinery, not a magical being, leading to the iconic line, "Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain." Well, because, as I said before, the majority of our cases settle, and you don't get to see what happens behind the curtain. We thought we would peel it back and show you what we do during that entire process where you're like, what happened between the time of the violation and the time you brought us the settlement? So that's what we're going to talk about now. The first concept that I want to discuss is one that probably you are already familiar with, and that is the concept of separation of functions. So when a case comes to our office, it's referred to our office. We assign an attorney to work with what we call the prosecution team. In your region and most other regions, the assistant executive officer serves as the prosecution team lead. Your enforcement coordinator and other technical staff, along with the attorney from the Office of Enforcement, make up the balance of that prosecution team. We, as the prosecution, are walled off from you and your advisory team, which is comprised of your OCC attorney, any other technical staff you want to advise you, your executive officer, and those others who you may want to bring in who have not served on the prosecution team. And the reason we separate functions really is because of fairness. We want to keep you and your advisors walled off from our staff so you can remain impartial. It would be wholly unfair if members of the prosecution team could call you or call your advisory staff and say, hey, look at the violations that I've got. Here's what I'm thinking about doing. Here's how I'd like you to vote on this matter. So it's just fundamental fairness. We maintain this separation throughout the entire process from the time that we get a referral and sometimes even before we get a referral when we're working with your staff to develop enforcement actions. Let's see. Okay, so as I said before, the vast majority of all of our enforcement cases do settle, and there's a number of reasons for this. We have certainty in the outcome when we resolve a case through settlement, which we don't necessarily have when we appear before you in a contested adjudicative proceeding. Generally, settlements take a lot fewer resources than bringing a case to administrative hearing. When we're working up a case for hearing, a lot of time and effort is involved in not only investigating the case, but a lot of legal maneuvering, including depositions, briefing, discovery, and other things that take a tremendous amount of time to bring before you. It's like going to trial. And then finally, and most importantly, as I talked about before, settlements allow you to do projects like SEPs, ECAs, and compliance projects that are not allowed if you do a contested hearing. The timing for settlement, we have a couple of options for when we start engaging in settlement with a discharger. Pre-complaint and post-complaint. Pre-complaint, I think, is what we do more frequently, and that is where before we send out a formal complaint, we will engage with the discharger. Normally, we'll send them a letter that says, hey, we've observed these violations. We intend to bring an enforcement action. Please come and meet with us. And if they say, yeah, that sounds good, we'll generally share a draft of our penalty methodology. And as I went through in tedious detail before, that's our 10-step methodology, which sets forth all of our factors for how we calculated the penalty. The other option is to issue the complaint first. Oftentimes, a discharger will waive the right to a hearing before you within 90 days, engage with us in settlement at that time. There's pros and cons to each approach. In the pre-complaint phase, it's a lot less pressure. We don't have a hearing requirement in 90 days. There's nothing formal that we've issued. We can have perhaps more open and honest discussions about the facts before we've put them out there publicly in a complaint. Many times it's more efficient. As I said before, if we issue a complaint, then we're sort of into the discovery phase and preparing for hearing. And probably most importantly, we can learn things about the case in a confidential context. So we can, perhaps, and actually I'll talk about this later, but we can get feedback from the discharger, and maybe there are things that we didn't know if we had already issued a complaint that we can incorporate into a settlement. Obviously, the downside is delay. There's nothing pending before you. The discharger can delay, and often that serves them well. For post-complaint issuing a complaint and then engaging in settlement, it shows that we're really serious, right? We have something that we've issued. We intend to bring it before you. It is moving forward. Sometimes that gives us greater leverage in a settlement. The downside, obviously, is we have to invest the staff resources and issue the complaint. A really important concept for settlement communications is that they are confidential. And there are a couple of statutes which provide for the confidentiality, both for the offers that we make and the responses from the discharger, 1152 and 1154. There's a real strong public interest to encourage consensual resolution of disputes. And to do that, we really have to be honest with each other and frank and open in our communications. And so what these statutes do is they prevent us from coming to a hearing and saying, you know, during settlement, they told us they would have accepted, you know, $500,000. So that's the floor. So how do we come to a compromise, and what are the rules surrounding how we justify that compromise? Often in settlement, as I said before, we learn new information about the facts that causes us to reconsider our position. We have several tools that we can use. We can issue subpoenas. We can issue 13267 orders. We might make other modifications to the enforcement policy methodology. The discharger might come to us and say, hey, you didn't consider the fact that we did X, Y, or Z, which should reduce my culpability, as you've said, 1.4 to a 1.1. We may not have had that information before. What is really important is the concept of transparency. When we do a settlement, there are no secret settlements. We have to be transparent. We will always bring to you our basis for a resolution. We will always show you that penalty methodology. All right. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Catherine, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions.
Okay. So to talk now a little bit about some of the projects that we consider within the context of settlements. Now, I'm going to spend most of the time talking about SEPs or supplemental environmental projects, but we'll talk about some other ones as well. And I think one of the reasons why we're here to talk to you today about SEPs is because this is an area where your staff is actively engaged in doing outreach with the community and, you know, work internally to develop appropriate projects, both in a general effort and in case-specific context as we resolve enforcement items. So what is a SEP? This is the definition up here on the screen, and I'll talk a little bit about the various elements that make up this definition. So the first thing is it's an environmentally beneficial project. That means that the SEP must improve, protect, or reduce risks to public health and the environment. The SEP policy, which is separate from the enforcement policy, provides that SEP shall directly benefit groundwater or surface water or drinking water quality or quantity and the beneficial uses of waters of the state. Next in this definition is the term voluntarily agrees to undertake. And that means that the project must not otherwise be required, and it must be something that goes above and beyond existing or likely to come into play obligations. And what it also means is that we can't bring a contested item to this board and the board orders the party to implement a SEP. This is something that can only be included as part of a settlement. And it is at the discretion of both the regulated entity who's subject to the enforcement action and the prosecution team as to whether or not to include a SEP. And this next portion is, I'm repeating myself a bit, but emphasizes that these projects, again, are only available in settlements and that they are to be memorialized in a settlement document, which we generally refer to as a stipulated order. And last but not least, a SEP is designed to offset a portion of civil liability. And that means that money which would otherwise be going to the cleanup and abatement account or the waste discharge permit fund is offset and directed towards a SEP instead. a question that I think is often in the minds of our board members is how do the parties to a settlement, which is the prosecution team and the discharger, find steps to include in the settlement? So many times the discharger will and can propose its own project. Oftentimes for public entities, a city or county, they may have projects themselves, which they are capable of implementing and proposing. And so those are what we would characterize as first party steps. A lot of times when we're dealing with private entities, we see third party steps, which is where the discharger hires or pays money to a third party group, maybe a nonprofit that's actively engaged in habitat restoration or other sort of community oriented projects. And the discharger works with that third party in order to implement a SEP. The Office of Enforcement maintains a SEP proposal form, which is available to members of the public in order to utilize and develop a project such that it can comply with the Water Board's SEP policy. And then many regions work directly with third parties based on community contacts. So these are nonprofits within the community that the regional boards work with and have relationships with that may propose projects directly to the regional board outside of a case-specific context. So what does the SEP policy require? I've alluded to the SEP policy several times here. It's much shorter than the enforcement policy, but it has important requirements that generally relate to the substance of what needs to be in a complete project proposal. We're required to include a detailed scope of work, a budget, time schedule for implementation, completion dates, and performance standards in order to ensure that there are success criteria to evaluate the project. Figuring out all of these details, while it's a reasonably short list on the screen, takes a lot of time. So when we're engaged in settlement, the decision to include a SEP often means that it's going to take much longer to resolve an enforcement action as compared to one where the funds go directly to the cleanup and abatement account. Depending on the level of project development and whether we're working with a third party, this process can take several weeks or several months. Generally, 50% of a total administrative civil liability can go towards the SEP, and that comes from our SEP policy. However, there are a few notable exceptions to this 50% rule. For mandatory minimum penalties, the statute itself provides alternative direction, indicating that the first $15,000 of MMPs plus 50% of the remaining liability can go towards a SEP. And then there are exceptions that are included within the SEP policy. And so the first of those exceptions is situations where the director of the Office of Enforcement has determined that there is a compelling justification due to exceptional circumstances. SEPs that fall into this first category are quite rare. However, what we see very regularly is the second bullet point there, which is projects which are located in or benefiting DAC or EJ communities or a community with a financial hardship, or for projects which further the human right to water, there is a general exception in place that allows the regional boards to move forward with those kinds of projects after having provided notice to the OE director. The SEP policy also provides guidelines on timeline, and this is a difficult area when we're working on developing projects, especially if we're looking at complex projects and habitat restoration. The policy requires that projects be completed within 36 months of the adoption of the stipulated order. So that's a 3-year timeline with some language that allows for an extension to 4 years based on a finding of projects providing an exceptional environmental benefit. Usually in our stipulated orders, there is language that allows for some sort of good cause delay. So if there's some sort of unforeseeable and unmanageable delay outside of the control of the discharger, then our stipulated orders do provide for extensions if good cause can be shown as to why that's merited. An important aspect of SEPs that's often a sticking point when we are in settlement negotiations with the discharger is that dischargers retain liability until the project is completed. So it's not as simple as writing a check to the cleanup and abatement account and the discharger is done worrying about its liability to the water board. When a stipulated order contains a SEP, the discharger retains liability until the project is completed. So even if they've written a check to the third party in order to implement the totality of the project, until those success criteria I mentioned earlier have been met and the project is completed and all the reporting obligations under the stipulated order are complied with, then the discharger remains liable for the administrative civil liability. All right, another kind of project that David mentioned that can be included in settlements of discretionary administrative civil liabilities only are enhanced compliance actions. These are different than SEPs because they are capital investments into the discharger's own system, which go above and beyond what they are required to implement. So unlike SEPs, which are primarily a benefit to the general public, enhanced compliance actions are to the benefit of the discharger. However, they go above and beyond merely bringing them into compliance. Like David said, if we want to order a discharger to comply, an enhanced compliance action is not the right tool. We will issue a cleanup and abatement order or a cease and desist order. These really provide dischargers an opportunity to invest in novel and emerging technology that may not otherwise financially be available to them. So that's generally where we are looking at ECAs, is when there's a particularly interesting compliance solution that can be pursued. And when we do include ECAs into our settlement agreements, the same reporting requirements and scope of work detail requirements I discussed in the context of SEPs also apply. All right, last but not least, this is our 45th slide here. We want to mention the process by which we get proposed settlements approved. So once the parties have reached an agreement in principle to resolve a case, we will proceed to notice as required by the federal regs for Clean Water Act violations and as a general matter of practice for non-Clean Water Act violations, we proceed to notice for public comment. So that's a 30-day public comment period. To the extent that comments are received, the prosecution team and the discharger together decide whether and how to respond to those comments. Very rarely, those comments may be of such significant nature that we would determine that the settlement needs to be rescinded. I have personally not experienced that in my career, but the possibility exists. Usually what happens is we can respond to the public comments in writing and no major modifications to the settlement package are merited. And then what happens is that we will present the settlement to the advisory team. And the advisory team has input on what happens next. So depending on the specific details of each case, that may be a case which is covered by the delegation, which your board has provided to the executive officer, and the EO may be able to adopt that settlement on behalf of the board. But the board can always provide more specific direction if it would like to have a settlement presented in open session. The prosecution team is happy to oblige, and we can bring it here to you all in order to present the facts of the settlement and allow the board to vote on whether to approve or reject the settlement. With that, I think we would be happy to answer any questions you all have on anything we said today, or like David said at the beginning, any burning questions you have on enforcement in general.
Thank you so much. I'd now like to bring it back to the board. Board Member Rue or members at the dais, does anyone have any questions?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have a very quick question. When we look at someone's or an entity, let me put it that way, ability to pay, how do you know whether they're being upfront, not us, with us?
Right.
You know, we have to look at their ability to pay. So they may give us, say, you know, I can't afford $50,000, I can only afford 10. I'm using an extreme example. How do we know that that is truly the case?
That's correct. So our enforcement policy in the statute requires that we consider a discharger's ability to pay the proposed penalty and remain in business. We're not required to impose a penalty that allows them to remain in business, but we are required to consider this factor. The practical reality of how this happens, either in the context of settlement or in front of the board, is that we are almost never just taking the discharger's word for what their ability to pay is. This is a sophisticated analysis. We retain an expert contract that has economists looking at financial records. We're looking at accounting. For public entities, most of that information is available publicly, but for private entities, they're going to have to come up with a boatload of papers in order for us to take a really detailed look at their tax returns, profit and loss statements, all sorts of accounting stuff. And if we proceed to hearing in settlement, usually that happens voluntarily. If we proceed to hearing in front of your board, very often we use subpoenas in order to subpoena the exact records we need in order to do that analysis I just mentioned.
And then our time doing that is taken into consideration, correct?
When we calculate staff costs, we generally calculate staff costs up until the issuance of an administrative civil liability complaint. And so those staff costs probably are not usually calculated as what we would recover. But, yeah.
Okay. I understand. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Board Member Rue. Vice Chair Scandura?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for the presentation, and certainly I think all of us have now been through the enforcement process, having had some cases brought to us for a decision. So certainly reviewing all of this is going to be helpful when we do this again. I had two questions. One question is really more for the staff. When we go back to slide 40, which is the discussion of the SEP policy requirements, and among other things includes detailed scope of work, budget, schedule for implementation. My question for the staff is, for our compensatory mitigation projects, this is where a developer comes in, they want to fill in ephemeral streams or channels or other kinds of things, and to compensate, they do some kind of mitigation, whether it's a wetland restoration or riverbank restoration. Does the developer also have to produce these kinds of items, the scope of work, budget, those sorts of things, or do they just simply say we're going to purchase X number of acres of mitigation credits, and we leave it to the party that does the mitigation to fill in all these details?
I guess the answer, Board Member Scandura, is I don't have the exact details. Roughly speaking, yes, we do get that same kind of breakdown. I'm not sure that it's a one-to-one match exactly, but generally speaking, yes. That checklist is a fair assessment of how we would look at a mitigation project.
So the developer would have to, for instance, produce a scope of work and budget and timeline for implementation and those kinds of things.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And then for our presenters, there was mention about settlements, and I'm one who, you know, having been in a regulatory agency, I too also support the concept of trying to reach a settlement first rather than going through the entire enforcement process. But one question I have is, you know, suppose you get a discharger who agrees to settle, and then you undertake the settlement negotiations, and what happens is, as you say, they delay. They cancel meetings, they postpone meetings, attorneys bring in all these ancillary questions, and you just can't seem to get to a settlement. At what point do you just simply say, okay, enough is enough, we've tried to negotiate in good faith, and we're not getting anywhere. It's time to go the full enforcement route.
I think every case is different. So I would say almost any case that ends up in front of you, we have made a good faith effort in engaging in settlement negotiations prior to bringing it to the board. If people don't respond to us, we're really left with no option except for to issue a complaint. People tend to, you know, show up in front of you all, even if they won't respond to my email. So I would say it's really different. There's no particular bright line where we say we've had 5 meetings with you, we're not going to meet anymore, we're going to settlement. Sometimes cases are really complex. They involve a lot of factual issues that, you know, really merit significant back and forth between staff, between the discharger, exchanges of photographs, evidence, consultants. Sometimes a lot of meetings is appropriate. Other times when we, you know, feel like we're spinning our wheels and we're talking about the same issues over and over again, that's really, and we can't make any sort of compromise or do so within the confines of the enforcement policy, that's when, you know, we feel like we have to take something to the board, and that's what we'll proceed to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Board Member Lopez.
I was just going to ask, is this policy throughout all the regions the same regardless of their environmental differences?
Yes. So this is the State Water Board's policy, and it applies equally to all 9 regional water boards and to the various enforcement programs that are contained within them. But it makes, you know, its language is broad enough in order to recognize the individual environmental priorities and impacts within various regions.
Thank you. And Board Member Alvarado?
And I just want to say thank you. I really think the updates are very, very good. Special, the one that I paid most attention on was the racial equity, the inclusion of it, the language behind it. Making sure that we're communicating, engaging, and that we are highlighting the fact that, you know, some of our Native American tribes might be affected, or some of the environmental justice, or even the disadvantaged communities are affected. So those are key points. Thank you so much for the great detailed presentation, 46 slides, yes, but very, very good. Thank you so much. We will use them as resources as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Board Member Alvarado. I'll add my thanks. Very thorough. We appreciate it. Especially, I just want to echo the appreciation for the DAC, EJ, and our tribal communities. Very important that that those communities are given deference and consideration in all of these policies when it pertains to enforcement and the protection of their communities. So thank you. And thank you for being here in person. We appreciate that as well.
Yeah, we're happy to have traveled down. And I'll just say, having worked with your staff for many years, that, you know, staff really takes those environmental justice and DAC considerations. We talk about them all the time in various cases where you might not even imagine that those interests come into play. But the language reflects what was already really important to the regional boards and the staff.
Thank you. All right. With that, we will move on to our next informational item on the an update on our cannabis program. The staff will provide an update on the South Coast Regional Cannabis Program activities, including updates on staffing, enrollment in the cannabis cultivation program, and enforcement within the Santa Ana, San Diego, and Los Angeles Regional Water Board areas. So with that, I'd like to ask Dr. Brian Covalone to present our cannabis update. Thank you.
Thank you, Board Chair. Mari, members of the board and members of the public here today. Wait a sec. Okay, great. Okay, my name is Brian Covalone. I'm the supervisor of the agriculture and cannabis section here at the Santa Ana Water Boards. The agriculture and cannabis section consists of our non-point source and irrigated lands program, as well as our confined animal feeding, our confined animal facilities program, as well as our cannabis program here. Okay, it's been a little over a year since I've addressed you, so I'm going to go over a couple things. I'd like to reintroduce you to the South Coast Cannabis Unit and our jurisdictional boundaries, talk about some significant staffing changes that we've had over the last few years, update you on enrollment, and then update you on some enforcement activities that we've had over the last few years. There we go. Okay, so you may have seen this slide in previous presentations. The South Coast Cannabis Regulation, or the South Coast Cannabis Regulatory Unit, represents 3 regional water boards. We represent the Los Angeles Regional Water Board, the Santa Ana Regional Water Board, as well as the San Diego Regional Water Board. Our jurisdictional area consists of large parts of 6 different counties, San Diego, Riverside, San Bernardino, Orange, Los Angeles, and Ventura counties, as well as bits of San Bernardino County. It's quite a large area. Here we go. This is our current staff. Our staff is made up of water resource control engineers as well as engineering geologists, many of whom are in this room today. So if you have any questions for us, feel free to poke us and have a conversation with us after this presentation. The role of the cannabis unit is really twofold. We do enrollment and compliance with the general order. It's a statewide general order. And that means we manage new and existing enrollments. We do public outreach. We review technical documents for approval, such as site plans, nutrient management plans, other plans like site stabilization plans. We ensure compliance with annual monitoring and reporting requirements, as well as doing compliance inspections of permitted cultivation sites. The other thing that we do is enforcement. And this makes up probably 3/4 of where we spend our time is enforcement. And this is investigations of unlicensed cultivation sites, usually in collaboration with other state agencies. So specifically the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Department of Cannabis Control, as well as local law enforcement agencies and district attorney offices. I'm happy that the enforcement item came before mine, because we're going to talk a bit more about this enforcement today. And we follow that same progressive enforcement policy that they spoke about in the previous presentation. And that starts with informal enforcement, such as voluntary cleanups in response to a notice or a notice of violation, formal enforcement, such as cleanup and abatement order, administrative civil liabilities. We also coordinate with non-cannabis program staff in our three regional boards where necessary for permitting and enforcement purposes. A quick look at our enrollment statewide in the program. So this is showing all of the cannabis regions. So our cannabis regions don't exactly align with our regional boards. For example, in the South Coast here, we're three regional boards. In Eastern California, they're also combined for Colorado and the Lahontan region. But statewide, we have about 4,400 enrollees. About half of those are in the North Coast, so the northwestern part of California. Down here in Southern California, I've broken it up into our three regional boards, Los Angeles, Santa Ana, and San Diego. You can see the vast majority of our enrollees are in the Los Angeles Regional Board region, about 493. We have 91 enrollees in the Santa Ana region and about 18 in San Diego, about 600 total enrollees in the South Coast region that we manage. I'm going to zoom into our region and take a better look at kind of the distribution of where those enrollees are and what type of enrollees enrollment they have with our region. So let me walk you through this kind of complicated figure here. From north to south, outlined in black, we have our three regional boards, Los Angeles, Santa Ana, and San Diego. In the background, in green, are cities and counties that have ordinances or regulations that specifically allow for the commercial cultivation of cannabis. In the hatches, the hatched background there, are cities and counties that specifically have ordinances or regulations in place that specifically prohibit the commercial cultivation of cannabis. The symbols are showing the type of notice of applicability that they're enrolled with in our region. So our notice of applicabilities come in two main flavors. A conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements, and that's the vast majority of our enrollees here in the South Coast region. And those waivers are either discharging their cannabis cultivation wastewater to a sewer system, which is shown in the blue dots, the blue circles, or they're having that wastewater tanked on the property and hauled off by a permitted wastewater hauler to a wastewater treatment facility, and those are shown in the red diamonds. In addition, we also issue waste discharge requirements for outdoor sites. We have a handful of those across our three regions. You can see a cluster up in Ventura, so kind of the northwestern part of the Los Angeles Regional Board, and then a cluster in San Jacinto. I'm going to zoom into the Santa Ana region here. So same figure, same symbology. And I want to point out the various clusters that we have. So we have a cluster of enrollees, all indoor enrollees in the Santa Ana region in Orange County. We have a cluster of indoor enrollees in the Lake Elsinore area. And then we have a cluster in the Paris area and Moreno Valley, Carupa area. And then we have a cluster in the San Jacinto and Hemet area. That's also where we have our outdoor cultivations shown there in the purple triangles. If we look at new enrollments per year, so on this figure, on the x-axis there is 3 years, 2022, 23, 24, and 25 as of the beginning of this month. In the checkerboard pattern there, on the y-axis is just a histogram, so that's just counts. The checkerboard pattern there is showing applications that we've received throughout those 3 years, and then notice of applicabilities that we've issued, so permits that we've issued in our office. The discrepancy between applications received and NOAs issued is typically because an applicant will sometimes apply and they have to they have to pay an application fee. That application fee may not be paid right away, so that would hold a notice of applicability. Or we also have the opportunity to flag that and review it. And we have some time to do that, to review it for various reasons. So that's why it's not a one-to-one ratio there between applications received and notice of applicabilities issued. I failed to mention on that regional slide the background. So we had the green where we allowed and the hatch marks where we prohibited. The areas that were not colored are typically public lands with the exception of being unincorporated San Diego County. Unincorporated San Diego County is actually in the process of drafting an ordinance right now. So this process began in January 2021 where the County Board of Supervisors directed the county to develop a socially equitable cannabis program for unincorporated San Diego County. Our staff have been involved in this process from the very beginning, from 2021. So we met with members of the county, as well as have regular meetings with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. We attend public scoping meetings. In September of 2023, the county published a notice of preparation of a draft environmental impact report. Our staff provided the county with comments on that. In January of 2025, the county published a draft environmental impact report. Our staff also provided comments on that. And just last week, we also met with the county, members of the county, to discuss our comments and any questions that they may have. So I'm pointing this out in that in the future, hopefully the near future, there will be another ordinance in place which will allow for commercial cannabis cultivation in unincorporated San Diego County, which would bring in more enrollees into our program in the southern half of our region. Okay, I'm going to switch gears here a bit to enforcement. Like I said, this is where we spend about 3/4 of our staff time. This enforcement, it could not be done successfully anyway without interagency coordination. And it's something that we do a significant amount of. We meet with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife on a biweekly basis for coordination meetings. We overlap jurisdictions with two California Department of Fish and Wildlife jurisdictions. We meet with both of those jurisdictional regions biweekly. We also have monthly triage meetings with the three main environmental agencies that are involved with commercial cannabis, and that is the Department of Cannabis Control, Fish and Wildlife, and the Water Board. So we have a monthly triage meeting for enforcement cases. Our staff regularly attends county environmental crimes task force meetings in San Diego, Riverside, Orange, and Ventura counties. I'll mention that San Bernardino and unincorporated Los Angeles County, we occasionally attend those also, but the large majority of those counties are located outside of our jurisdiction, the city of Los Angeles notwithstanding. The California Environmental Protection Agency, so CalEPA, also hosted training sessions over the last couple years to various county district attorney offices on prosecuting environmental crimes. Our role in that was as the experts on California Water Code and how California Water Code links and is a nexus to California Health and Safety Code, which county DA offices can use to prosecute crimes for unlicensed cannabis cultivation. So we participated in and presented in those trainings in Riverside County, San Diego County, and Ventura counties in 2023, and more recently, this past January, in Orange County. That Orange County event also included members from Los Angeles County. And last one, in May 2025, we were also invited to present on an enforcement case study at the 38th Annual California Hazardous Materials Investigators Association Training Conferences. This is something we also do on a regular basis. So this slide just highlights all the interagency coordination we do. We are not on an island at all. We work very closely with all of our partners. This figure here is showing inspections by year. Again, I'm looking at 2022 through 2025 as of the first week of June. I've broken this up into enrolled sites. So those are sites that have a notice of applicability with our office, as well as unenrolled sites. So unlicensed, unenrolled properties. And you can see that, you know, we do about 50-ish inspections of unenrolled sites every year. We'll see a big bump in the summertime. That's kind of our high season, so that the 2025 numbers, we'll see a bump between like July, August, September. The enrolled sites, I want to point out here, inspections of enrolled sites are typically in response to a complaint, and those complaints could come from our county partners, maybe code enforcement, county department of environmental health or public health, or our sister agencies such as Fish and Wildlife, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, I mean, as well as the Department of Cannabis Control. This map I'm going to walk you through again. This is showing the distribution of our unlicensed sites inspected. So unlicensed, unenrolled cannabis cultivation sites throughout three regions. Again, from north to south, Los Angeles, Santa Ana, and San Diego. In the background, you see a light blue color. Those are major waters of the state in our regions. The darker blue is waters of the state that are impaired for one thing or another, one constituent or another. The symbols are showing individual site inspections. This is showing all the site inspections we've done since the program began in mid-2018. So there's about 406 site inspections that we've done between 2018 and the present. I want to point out the distribution of those. annually, the Water Board, so each regional cannabis region, so we meet with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we designate areas where we want to prioritize enforcement. The way we designate those areas where we want to prioritize enforcement are based on the presence of various things, but among them are the presence of higher order streams, impaired water bodies, designated high quality, high priority water streams in water systems in those regional boards, wild and scenic rivers, as well as the size or density of cultivation sites, again, accounting for that cumulative effect of multiple cultivations in one area, disadvantaged communities, overdrafted groundwater basins, and drinking water supplies. So we take all of this into consideration on an annual basis in coordination with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we determine areas where we want to prioritize for enforcement. So that's why you're seeing various clusters of where we've inspected over the last 7 years, I guess. Had to do some mental math there. Okay, so like I said, we follow our progressive enforcement process that was described in the previous talk. Our progressive enforcement process begins with informal enforcement actions. That first bullet point here is something that's unique to the cannabis program. The first thing that we do is issue something called a field notice of water quality violations. This is posted at the property. In the next couple slides, I'm going to show you what that looks like. After that field notice, we'll come back to our staff will come back to the office. They'll draft up an inspection report and typically a notice of violation if it's warranted and issue that to the landowner via mail. I want to point out that in the last 2 years, really since the implementation of this field notice of water quality violations, it started about a year and a half ago. In the last 2 years, we've achieved voluntary cleanup on approximately 50% of the inspected sites that we've gone to in the last 2 years. And that's significant. It's a significant increase prior to that. And I attribute that to the field notice, but also members of our staff who are willing to engage with people, have productive conversations, and are able to speak to them in Spanish. That has also been a big boon to this. This is a look at that field notice of water quality violations. It's a two-pager. This field notice is an old-school triplicate. If you remember going to the bank and you have that white, yellow, and pink copy, that's what this is here. We're using that old-school triplicate, and our inspectors take this to the site. I'm going to walk through this. They take this to the site. They fill it out. They leave the top copy, the original copy, on the property. They post it on a door, on a fence, somewhere where it's visible so that whoever comes back to the site can see that right away. There's contact information that shows us how to contact us. and then we'll take a copy and we'll give a copy to whoever the lead inspecting agency is. So typically these are under search warrant. So whatever that lead agency is, whether it's Fish and Wildlife or whether it's your local law enforcement agency, we'll also provide them a copy. The second page of that, so on the right there, just shows the definition of the most common water code violations that we see. So if we're marking this off, somebody looking at this can read that, and then they have that information right there for them. They don't have to go online and look it up or contact an attorney. They can look up what that water code states right there. The first part of that, so section one is just basic information about the site. I'm going to zoom in to sections, click, two and three. That's the meat of it. Sections two and three here describe our two most common water code violations that we observe on cannabis cultivation sites. That would be water code 13260 and water code 13264. So our staff, depending on their observations, would check one or both of those boxes, and then they would go to section three and then provide additional information. So your actual discharge, that would be more related to 13264, and your threatened discharge more related to 13260. They can check that off for whatever it is, whether it's sediment, wastewater, fertilizers, soils, petroleum products, and then they can provide note if they also need to. I'll go back a slide. And then that last section there, four, is where they have their contact information. Okay. The next two slides I'm going to show you are inspections with the addition of that orange bar there, which is notice of violations. The numbers here are the same as what I showed you previously. So the only thing that's changed in this particular slide is the y-axis here. But that black and white hash marks, that's an inspection of, that black and white hashed bar is our inspections of enrolled sites, which you saw in the previous couple slides ago, and then the notice of violations issued. So that shows the number of notice of violations that we've issued after inspection of enrolled sites. And like I said, most of our enrolled inspections are in response to a complaint. So it's not that surprising that we see this kind of distribution of, you know, the relative ratio of notice of violations towards inspections for enrolled sites, because they're typically in response to a complaint. Same setup for unenrolled sites. So green is your unenrolled inspections and notice of violations through the last three and a half years. Okay, I want to preface this next slide with the fact that all of the information I'm going to present to you on this slide and in the coming slides has already been presented publicly, is already publicly posted elsewhere. So I'm not presenting any new information here, no evidence that would complicate ongoing enforcement cases. This has already been presented publicly. With that, on this slide, I would like to highlight some significant enforcement actions that we've taken over the past couple of years. I want to start with an administrative civil liability case. This is a case that was in the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board. It's for a site in Ranchita in San Diego County. In the next couple slides, I'm actually going to show you more. I'm going to get into more detail about this case, but just a quick overview. We issued a cleanup and abatement order to this case in 2021. It shows that at that last bullet there on the slide, San Diego R9 2021-0165. We issued that cleanup and abatement order in 2021. Despite many attempts at compliance insistence over 3+ years, we were still unable to get compliance on that cleanup and abatement order. And that led us to issue an administrative civil liability complaint in May of 2024 for violations of that cleanup and abatement order. Our staff proposed a liability amount of $409,534. An initial public hearing was held at the October 9th San Diego Water Board's meeting. October 9th, 2024, San Diego Water Board's meeting. That item was continued to December 11th, the December 11th Water Board meeting. At the December 11th San Diego Water Board meeting, the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board decided to adopt that administrative civil liability order for the full complaint amount of $409,534. Since December of 2024, the respondent did file a petition with the state board on January 10th, 25. That petition was dismissed by operation of law on April 11th, 2025, and this is still an ongoing case that we're managing, as well as the associated cleanup and abatement order that was issued in 2021. That is still active and ongoing. On a more positive note, The next bullet is a cleanup and abatement and investigative order that was also issued in 2022 for a site in Vista, San Diego County. This was also in the San Diego Water Board's jurisdictional region. We issued a cleanup and abatement order in 2022. Again, I'll get into more specifics of this on the coming slides, but we, after a couple years of compliance assistance and working with that discharger, we did achieve, cleanup on the property, and they did meet all the requirements to close that cleanup and abatement order, and we issued them a no further action letter in January of 2025. So that's a really great success story and shows a discharger who was willing to work with us, after issuance of a cleanup and abatement order. In terms of active cleanup and abatement or investigative orders, we have, there's two currently in the Santa Ana region, one that was issued in 2022 in Homeland, Riverside County, and one that was issued just last week for a site in Lake Elsinore. Okay, these next couple slides here, I want to dive more into that Ranchita example to give you kind of a sense of what a site looks like when we decide to elevate that to formal enforcement. And like I said, all of this was presented previously publicly, so I'm not sharing any new information with the board or the public right now. So let me walk you through the photo first. So north is to the right of the screen there. Outlined in blue are ephemeral streams. So those are waters of the state. Those are ephemeral streams that are designated on the National Hydrography data set, but they are also have been confirmed by our geologists and engineers in the field, so on-site ground-truthed. For a sense of scale, kind of the bottom middle there, you see a residential structure. That's like a double wide manufactured home. You can see various large SUVs and trucks parked around there as little dots. There's a barn kind of in the path of that blue stream there, as well as what is a large area with greenhouses inside of it. That area is about 1.5 acres in size. It's surrounded by an earthen berm. That earthen berm, just for a sense of scale, is about 10 to 12 feet high. Inside of that is a number of greenhouses, which have changed over the years. This site, six search warrants were served on this site between 2019 and 2021 by San Diego County Sheriff's Department. Santa Ana Water Board, Cannabis Cultivation staff, Water Board staff, were present for four of those inspections between 2019 and 2022. During that time, we sent the landowner multiple notices of violation. Ultimately, we had to issue a cleanup order, an investigative order in 2021. That was meant to restore the stream channel, do a sediment analysis, as well as clean up buried waste, which I'm going to show you in another slide. Unfortunately, like I said previously, despite multiple attempts at compliance assistance over 3+ years, we were unable to get compliance with that, and we issued the complaint, and ultimately the order was adopted by the San Diego Water Board on December 11th, 2024. This is what that looks like on the ground. The top left I'll start with, that's inside of one of the greenhouses. You can see that the greenhouses were flood irrigated, so you see all the water in that greenhouse. Let me back up a slide I failed to mention. That red arrow in the top left corner there, that's pointing to irrigation wastewater that's going to be discharged off outside of that bermed area, and I'm going to show you that here. So all of that irrigation wastewater was then discharged into that bermed area and out of that top left corner that was on the previous slide. That's the bottom left photo there. So you see all of that liquid. There's a debris dam, if you will, that was not sure what the purpose of that was, but all of that water went through that debris dam. The bottom right photo is actually me. I'm standing on top of the berm and looking south off of the property, and you could see that red arrow is pointing to all of that irrigation wastewater being discharged off of the property, southward to the neighbor's property. In addition to those irrigation wastewater discharges, there was two areas on the property that they used to bury, they excavated and used to bury trash. This trash included household waste, but also nutrients, pesticides, and various whatever else they could throw in there. The location of those are in the two corners of that bermed area. Again, for a sense of scale, those excavated areas were about 15 feet deep. The second example I want to show you was the cleanup and abatement order where we issued a no further action level in Vista, California. On this site, a warrant was served and the site was inspected in July 2021. We observed unauthorized surface water discharge, or excuse me, surface water diversion. That top right photo there, it's a little bit difficult to see, but that's a stream that crosses the property. There's a submersible pump in that stream. There's a ladder to the bottom right. So there's a submersible pump in that stream, and that pump was taking that water from that stream and irrigating the cultivation. We also observed discharges of petroleum products to the land. You can see the bottom two photos there, all the stained soil. There was two large generators on site that were used for power, as well as various petroleum products that were stored on the site and then spilled on the property, as well as unauthorized discharges for cannabis cultivation-related waste and the storage of banned and restricted pesticides. As I said, we issued a notice of violation in July 2021. We issued a final cleanup and abatement order in September 2022. There was a couple comment periods and revisions to that draft cleanup and abatement order. That's the lag time there. The first step of that cleanup and abatement order, and for all of our cleanup and abatement orders usually, is submittal of something called a proposed restoration and monitoring plan. And that's a plan of how the discharger is going to address the observations that we made and that we're allowed to review and approve. So we went through multiple rounds of that, as well as multiple rounds of investigative soil sampling. You could see on the two left-hand photos there, the top photo is showing kind of an initial soil sampling to get a sense of the distribution and potential impacts to the soil. The bottom left one there is a more targeted soil sampling event that happened. After multiple rounds of soil sampling, the discharger then excavated impacted soil and hauled that off to the appropriate waste disposal area. The bottom right photo there shows, it's hard to see in red there, but it shows the depth of final excavation. So for three of those greenhouses, we excavated down to 6 inches. For the one that's labeled C, it was excavated down to a foot and 2 feet in one of the corners. Like I said, after about 3 years or so, they had met all the requirements of a cleanup and abatement order. They backfilled that area with clean soil, and we issued a no further action letter in January of 2025. This is what it looks like on the site, shows kind of some of the progress during the excavation, and that bottom right there is what the site looks now with clean backfill. So this is a really great success story for us. And then the last example I'm going to show you is what is typical of our sites. So when I said we get voluntary compliance on approximately 50% of those properties, what does that look like? What do I mean by that? So this slide here shows from multiple sites. This is not one site, but typically what we see here is a lot of trash, debris, nutrient containers, things like that, plastics, infrastructure, in areas that present a risk to our water quality, to present a risk to waters of the state, not only to water quality, but also water flow. If we just look at the top left one with the arrow, so there was a greenhouse. It was in kind of a natural drainage area. Circled in red is just kind of a natural feature, so you can match that up in the after picture. So we have a before picture and then an after picture. So you can see to the right of that with the showing the arrow what it looks like after that voluntary cleanup. So that infrastructure was removed from that area, and there's no longer trash and debris there. The one directly below that, that's actually an ephemeral stream. So we're right in the middle of an ephemeral stream. It again had lots of cultivation infrastructure, plastic, trash, things like that. And now after voluntary cleanup, that stream is now clean and clear. The other examples there are just kind of showing the accumulation of stuff that gets hauled off of these sites. So, you know, piles of plastics, debris, potting containers, soils, impacted soils, things like that. A couple roll-off bins. The one on the middle right there is kind of a drone footage, and you could kind of see the former cultivation area in the middle of the picture, and then a truck with a roll-off bin full of trash that was removed there. It's kind of blurry. Sorry about that. But this is pretty typical of the majority of sites and typical of the sites that I say achieve that voluntary compliance. These are sites that you know, if they do this, are not going to need a full-blown cleanup and abatement order or an investigative order. We can just achieve that compliance assist. We can help them with that, with compliance assistance and clean up those sites without moving to a formal enforcement action. And that's our goal. And with that, I would thank you for listening and happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much. So I'd like to see if Board Member Rue or any of our representatives up on the dais have any questions. Board Member Lopez. Thank you, Board Member Rue. Board Member Lopez.
What are some of the risks involved in this enforcement? Obviously, not everyone's happy to see you when you come up on their property, but, you know.
Sure. Yeah, the risks to staff, you mean? The risk to staff or the risk to water quality? Either one. Okay, so I'll address the risk to staffs first. So, thank you for pointing that out, board member. We are typically accompanied by law enforcement agencies, so we are not writing our own warrants. So we're usually a rider on a warrant with another law enforcement agency. Typically, that is the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. So we work with both their wardens as well as their environmental staff who are also with us. So there's a lot of safety precautions that are followed, you know, before we go into those before those warrants are served. We're typically our science people, water boards as well as fish and wildlife science people, are typically the last people on the property after the property has been cleared as safe by law enforcement. I would say the largest risks to staff are the unknowns in terms of pesticides. So we do see a lot of banned and restricted pesticides. And what I mean by that is these are pesticides that do not have an EPA registration number. They're pesticides that have been banned for, you know, sometimes 50 years for possession in the United States, not just use. Possession of these pesticides is banned in the United States. We see that on a percentage of the sites. So being aware of those risks is something that we take very seriously. Our staff receive specialized training once they're part of the cannabis program. So we have our regular training that most water board staff has, as well as specialized training that's specific to cannabis. In terms of the risk to water quality, it would be from obviously significant nutrients that are being added to both our streams, but as well as our groundwater over years. Discharges of pesticides, both to surface water and groundwater, as well as one that's not maybe super obvious to everybody is sediment. We see a lot of unauthorized grading, specifically in and around streams. Ephemeral streams are typically the easiest place to grow things. They're flat and they're clear. So we see quite a bit of sediment disturbance that does present a significant risk to our ephemeral streams, both for water quality, habitat, and flow. I would say those are the main risks to water quality that we encounter. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. Any other questions?
Sure.
Okay. Vice Chair Scandura.
Okay. And first of all, thank you for the presentation. I was going to point out that attaining voluntary cleanup on about 50% of your sites, I mean, that's pretty extraordinary because we understand a lot of these cultivators are pretty notorious, very difficult to deal with. So I think that's a really good number. I just wanted to verify. So you mentioned about the Ranchita and the Vista sites. I take it, first of all, those were never enrolled in any of our programs. And did they get any kind of land use permit of any sort from, you know, the county or the local land use authority?
That's correct. They were not enrolled in the cannabis program. They were not licensed with the Department of Cannabis Control, and they did not have any sort of authorization from any other regulatory agency, local, state, or otherwise.
Yeah, because it looked like they were a pretty large scale operation, especially that Ranchita set where there's all the greenhouses. And then the other question, or the last question I was going to ask is, so when you're, I noticed that, you know, large proportions of, you know, these counties, cultivation is off limits, is prohibited. And so when you go on to one of these sites in these unincorporated areas, does anybody from the local law enforcement agencies accompany your staff?
Yeah, for those unlicensed sites, all the time, 100% of the time. So we do not go to an unenrolled site without being accompanied by some sort of law enforcement staff. Like I said, it's typically Fish and Wildlife because they're our closest sister agency, California Fish and Wildlife, I should clarify. So it's typically Fish and Wildlife. And like I said, they're usually bringing along their science staff as well as their warden staff. So we are always accompanied by somebody.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what proportion of sites are you accompanied by the local law enforcement agencies?
It varies from year to year. They actually work in coordination with each other. So typically, operations will have both Fish and Wildlife and your local law enforcement agency. In terms of like a typical percentage, I would say, maybe 60% is okay. Fish and Wildlife led. And then maybe the other 40 is local law enforcement led, but Fish and Wildlife is typically present also. It's just a matter of which agency is the author of the warrant and taking lead on the investigation.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate how thorough this is. Also knowing, you know, that sometimes these situations can be dangerous. So I'm glad that you clarified that law enforcement is there with you. We need to protect our environment. We don't want our staff to be put in harm's way with some of these unlicensed operators. So thank you for your time and your presentation.
Thank you.
With that, we'll move on to item 15, which is our executive officer's report.
I don't have a report today. Thank you.
Okay, and then item 16, are there any board member executive, it's really just executive officer communications. Does anyone have anything for the good of the order?
Thank you. No, I just want to say that I had the opportunity to attend the conference for the water quality control. Did I get it right?
Yep.
Yeah, that committee. Yeah, I had the opportunity to attend, and it was very interesting. There was a lot of dialogue and among the participants, and you know the presentations were great. You know, very informative, and I really appreciate the opportunity to go and how would you say commingle with the other attendees. One of the highlights of the conference was the expectations of the appointed regional quality control board members, of which you heard earlier. There was a lot of discussion on that, and I think if a draft was presented, and I think that there's probably being modified because of as a result of the discussions. But it was very interesting, and I thank the board for allowing me to attend. Thank you.
Thank you for being there. Board Member Alvarado.
I just wanted to highlight how important the work that the Regional Quality Board provides, and not only us, but the staff. Thank you to the staff for all the presentations. We heard earlier how water is a human right, and to preserve the quality and to preserve our waters in California is extremely important for our communities. I want to thank you for all the effort and all the work. Muchas gracias a todo el equipo, especialmente porque sabemos que el agua es algo que toda la humanidad necesita saber que es especial y que tenemos derecho a ella. Y el equipo de todas las regiones que cuidan la calidad del agua están haciendo el esfuerzo para que todos tengamos una experiencia y la calidad del agua muy buena. So muchas gracias a todas las regiones. Thank you, and I thank you for allowing me to actually give testimony of your work in Spanish.
Thank you for doing that. Yes, for Vice Chair Skender.
Sure. And I too attended the WQCC conference with Board Member Lopez, and I also echo his remarks on that one. Apparently, the next conference, they're going to move the conference from from October to May. So I think they're looking at the next conference being around May 1st or 2nd, something like that.
Thank you. Board Member Rue, did you have any final comments?
No, Madam Chair, I do
okay.
Not.
Thank you. With that, I just want to thank everyone who was here in person and who participated virtually today. Thank you for your attention and engagement on these matters, which are so essential to our greater region's quality of life. To our staff and everyone who presented, thank you. We respect and value your work and appreciate the commitment you have to everyone who lives and works in our region. With that, we will move on now to item 16, which is a closed session item. I'm sorry, we just finished item 16. We're moving now into closed session, and I'll turn it over to Council Jennifer Fordyce to announce that item.
Thank you. The board's going to adjourn to closed session to discuss item B on the closed session list, which is consideration of the appointment of the executive officer. And the board does not have any more open session items on the agenda, so the meeting will be adjourned immediately after the conclusion of the closed session, just so people don't necessarily have to wait around if they don't want to.
All right, everyone. Just want to acknowledge that we have concluded our closed session, and the meeting of June 13th, 2025 is officially adjourned. Thank you so much.